the Treasury Star Parade. With a few American citizens from the territory of Hawaii, Al Goodman and his orchestra and chorus, and Henry Hall as our master of ceremonies.
Many bonds today, bonds of freedom, bonds with many bonds today.
This is Henry Hall, ladies and gentlemen, with another of the new electrical transcriptions brought to you by the Treasury Department. Now, it's quite possible that many of you who heard Larry Elliott say that we had a few citizens from Hawaii with us may have concluded that you were going to hear sweet music on this program. Well, you're going to hear music, but I don't know just how sweet it'll be. Something took place on the island of Oahu, territory of Hawaii, December 7th last. One of the men who were there and saw what happened wrote a book. That book he called Remember Pearl Harbor. At this moment, that man is here by my side. Ladies and gentlemen, I want you to meet Mr. Blake Clark, a native Tennessean, and for the past 12 years, professor of English at the University of Hawaii.
Good evening. All my life, I've wanted to live history. I've had my wish. I did not see it all with my own eyes, but from what I did see, and from talking to friends and others who were in the thick of it, I have lived through real history, the history of Pearl Harbor. Its beginning was as calm as the South Seas, and its ending as angry and determined as the United States Marines who cry for revenge of Wake Island. Honolulu is one of the most peaceful cities in the world. On that particular Sunday, it seemed more peaceful than usual. Most of us were just getting out of bed or having breakfast when the shooting started. Mr. and Mrs. Freer, with whom I was living on Punahou Street, were already at the table when I came down. There was a rumbling outside. Their Japanese houseboy, Yamato, came running in.
Oh, plenty plane outside. Come see.
Yes, I can hear them.
Much pop guns booming also.
Practicing, eh? Well, that's good. We ought to get ready.
Come across lawn, neighbor lady, Miss Clare, fast running.
Mr. Freer, we're under attack. The Japanese are bombing Oahu.
Oh, no, now, it's only practice. Don't get excited,
Well, if
Claire.
You don't believe me, turn on your radio.
We turned on the radio and heard the voice of Webb Edwards, KGMB station manager.
Keep calm, everybody. Oahu is under attack. Keep calm, everybody. Oahu is under attack. This is no joke. It's the real McCoy. The emblem of the rising sun has been seen on the wings of the attacking plane.
Yamato wouldn't believe it. Words tumbled from him, incredulous, pleading words.
Oh, no, Yamato not think so. They no fight. In Washington, Kuruzu, you know, Kuruzu and the president still talk. No fight. Still talk. Oh, no.
No fight. Still talk. A funny kind of talk. And hell had broken loose on the flying fields and in Pearl Harbor. Everything was close together. Everything happened at once. By the time the first wave of attacking planes was approaching Pearl Harbor and Hickam Field, the second was already dropping bombs on Wheeler Field. One woman was watching from her bedroom what she thought was a mock raid until a plane roared swooping down over a warship in the harbor. A terrific explosion followed as the plane swooped up again. The whole end of the island seemed to be on fire. She called excitedly to her little girl.
Roberta, run outside and get your brother!
Roberta ran down the walk to where her little brother and his pal were playing with a small wooden wagon. As they started back toward the house, a plane flew low above them and splattered the sidewalk with machine gun bullets. The wagon flew to pieces on the lawn. A truck drew up to the door.
Get out of the house! Don't bring anything! Hurry!
A bomb hit on a hangar announced the news to the thousands on the post at Hickam Field. Men came pouring out from all nine wings of the barracks. Men in slacks, men in shorts, some in their underwear only, some without anything at all. What was going on? Another mock war? No. Bombs. Everyone ran for clothes and then for its battle station. The enemy planes were bombing the hangars and strafing the quarter-mile-long row of planes drawn up in front of the hangars in orderly parade formation. Colonel Ferguson came running down the field, jumped into a gutter to escape the machine gun bullets, shouted his orders to the men.
Disperse those planes!
The men ran out toward the line, heedless of the rain of bullets. Some of them faltered and fell. Then came the second wave of planes. For what seemed a full minute, there was dead silence in which nothing happened. Then, the new mess hall, large enough for six complete basketball courts inside, the photograph laboratory, the guardhouse, the fire station, the barracks built to house thousands, an immense hangar, everything in the entire area seemed to rise intact from the earth, poise in midair, and fall apart, dropping back to earth in millions of fragments and clouds of dust. There were men mixed up in those clouds of dust. At Wheeler Field, the crowd was anxiously watching Lieutenant Rasmussen in a dogfight with the Japanese over the pineapple fields at Wahiawa. Each was desperately maneuvering to get on the other's tail. Bullets ripped into Rasmussen's plane. His radio equipment fell to pieces before his eyes. Then he caught the Japanese in his sights. He pulled the trigger. Tracer bullets tore into the enemy plane, and the anxious thousands broke into a great cheer of relief and pride when it fell to the ground in a burning, broken mass of wreckage. The courage of our men everywhere was inspiring. Sergeant Bam tore down to the supply house for a machine gun. The door was down, and Bam dragged out a 50-caliber gun. When he had finally got it mounted, somebody cried out,
"Hey, Sergeant, you can't fire that water-cooled gun without water!"
"The hell with water! I haven't got any water!"
In 1 hour, boys became men, and men became heroes. One fireman climbed into his truck and set out for the line to put out the fire. Strafers, attracted by the bright red truck, attacked him before he got halfway to the plains. He didn't stop until a third wave shot the tires off his wheels. An officer commented dryly on his driving into a hail of machine gun bullets.
"Hell, Lieutenant, I saw a fire, and I'm supposed to put him out."
And that's the way it went. Green men under fire, acting like veterans, all moved swiftly to their places without any confusion or disorder. The cooks ran back into the kitchen to remove all the food stored there to a safer place. The kitchen was hit. The staff sergeant in charge was struck on his head by a piece of shrapnel. He ripped off his shirt, tied up his head to stop the blood, and went on directing his work. Outside, a corporal was speedily running across the parade ground to help man a machine gun. It was entirely in the open, without any protection whatever. Halfway there, he was strafed by a low-flying Japanese pilot. Mortally wounded, he kept on, trying to get to that machine gun. He fell dead on the way. Inside a smoke-filled hangar, 21 Hawaiians with Solomon Na'au'au, 245-pound athletes, were fighting fire. One end of the burning hangar fell through to the floor, revealing a sky dotted with three approaching Japanese bombers. They were flying just a few feet above the hangar. The first one passed directly above Solomon and his fellow fighters. Solomon heard an explosion and felt hot with pain. "Lord, help me," he prayed, falling to the concrete floor. The whole inner side of his right leg was blown away. But what happened at the flying fields was only a prelude to the drama of Pearl Harbor. From the crow's nest of one of the battleships, a sailor saw a torpedo coming straight for the side of his ship. A massive battleship of thousands of tons, it rocked as if hit by a mighty fist. Almost simultaneously with the explosion, quantities of oil flew all over the ship. The oil caught fire. In 2 minutes, the deck of the ship and the water around it were one mass of flames, and men were trying to swim in that blazing oil. On the Arizona, one bomb dropped like a plummet down the funnel and set off the forward magazine where ammunition was stored. In one blinding flash, the whole inside of the forward ship blew up, leaving only a mass of shattered, burning wood and twisted metal. Bodies of the dead were thick on the deck, and some were hanging from the forecastle. Men were running out of the flames, so badly burned that they were barely able to stand. Clothes burned away. No eyelashes. No hair. They stumbled along, feeling their way, helpless, falling on the deck, jumping over the side. Yet when the ranking surviving officer, who was supervising the saving of the wounded, was asked when he was going to leave, his answer was, "Not until the Japs leave." By this time, the wounded had begun to pour into the hospitals. Every laundry truck, every lumber truck, and delivery wagon on the island was used to move them. They were carried in by the hundreds, and yet there was no confusion, no unnecessary clamor, no crying out. They spoke quietly instead.
"Watch that leg, please, ma'am. It's broken in two places."
A doctor went up to a young boy. His skin was burned and dripping off his entire upper body, but he looked at the doctor.
"Take care of my buddy here, Doc. He's hurt lots worse than I am."
You heard that sentence spoken often.
Chaplain, see if you can't find a doctor right away. My buddy's in terrible shape. He's been lying here 10 minutes now."
The surgeon looked at one boy whose leg was about to be amputated, and the boy smiled at him.
"Aren't you afraid, soldier?"
No, not at all. Only hurry up. I
I want to get back to my battle station.
At 11 in the morning, over the radio came the voice of Dr. Pinkerton.
This is a call for volunteer blood donors. Report immediately to Queen's Hospital.
That was all. He did not say how badly plasma was needed. He did not explain. But in half an hour, 500 people were waiting at the doors of the hospital. Most of them didn't know what plasma was, but they knew that they were helping. Defense workers in their dirty clothes, welders with eyes red and burning, Honolulu society women, alien Japanese dressed in black in protest at what Japan had done, a Portuguese blind boy and his blind sister, a huge Hawaiian who joked teasingly at a Puerto Rican who was frightened a little.
Wait till you get that shot of brandy at the end of the line. Boy, you feel number 112.
Mr. and Mrs. Freer went down. He is 78 and she is 72. When someone objected that they might be too old, Mrs. Freer said,
I don't know. It ought to be very good blood. It's lasted us for a long time.
Everyone that day wanted to do something. We knew what had happened to us. We knew that the Oklahoma had turned over, that the Arizona was lost, that flames were leaping from the Downs, the Catlin, and others. There had been more damage done in an hour than our fleet suffered in the entire World War. Men were killed and wounded, dying on every field, in Pearl Harbor, and in the streets of Honolulu. Airplanes, ships, and homes were afire. But the Japanese imperialists lit a new fire that day, which will sweep over the world, carrying democracy and liberation even to Japan's own people. On New Year's Day, Honolulu paid its respects to the 3,000 dead in a memorial service at Nu'uanu. Hawaiian women dressed in black placed flower leis the full length of the grave. Fleet Chaplain McGuire spoke for us all with respect and anger in his voice.
Let no one think these men have died in vain. 130 million Americans would have glowed if they could have seen how our boys died. They manned their guns until the decks buckled under them from the heat. Not a whisper, not a moan. It was glorious. Don't say we buried our dead with sorrow. They died manfully. They were buried manfully. And we will avenge their death, come what may.
Doubted the courage or the fortitude of the American people under fire. No one has ever doubted their ability to get things done once they made up their minds. And the American people have made up their minds. We're going into this war to win, and we're all going to do our share. There's not even any room to argue about that. And we are going to buy United States war savings bonds and stamps as one of the ways to make sure that we're going to win it. We're going to buy them regularly. We're going to get the habit. And we're going to join the Treasury payroll savings plan wherever we work. We're going to keep on working, and we're going to keep on saving, and we're going to keep on buying war stamps and bonds. Because this is our country, and we're going to keep it ours.
And thanks to distinguished artists who donated their talents to this electrically transcribed performance. The orchestra and chorus were under the direction of Al Goodman, writing by Malcolm Meacham and Violet Dutch, produced by William A. Dacey. This is Ari Elliott speaking.